today on Against the Grain. When the U.S. flexes its muscles in the Asia-Pacific region, Guam often plays a prominent role. What's less prominent is what U.S. militarism has done there to communities and cultures and livelihoods, and to ecological systems both on and offshore. I'm C.S. Craig Santos Perez tells stories, true stories, of exploitation, migration, and resistance coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. They're small, I mean really small, but they are a big deal to U.S. military planners, and they have been for more than a century. I'm talking about the Pacific Islands, a subset of which are the Mariana Islands, one of which is Guam, which became a U.S. territory in 1898. Now, we can say the words colonialism and militarism, but Craig Santos Perez has investigated their real-life manifestations and impacts on landscapes, on cultures, and on the physical and mental and emotional health of individuals. Perez, a poet and an English professor at the University of Hawaii, Manoa, is a native Chamorro from Guam. Chamorros are the indigenous people of Guam and the Marianas. Craig Santos Perez won an American Book Award for his book, From Unincorporated Territory, Guma, and when he joined me in studio, he began by reading the first poem in the volume.
From the Legends of Juan Malo. Guam is where America's day begins. Guam is the westernmost, furthest forward sovereign U.S. territory in the Pacific. Guam is a non-self-governing colony. Guam is a U.S. citizen ever since the 1950 Organic Act. Guam is part of the U.S. Postal System, GU 96910 through 96932. Guam reps the 671. Guam is a duty-free port outside the U.S. Customs Zone. Guam is expected to homeport the Pacific Fleet. Guam is an acronym for Give Us American Military. Guam is a pivot point in the realignment of U.S. forces in the Pacific. Guam is a target. Guam is America's front porch to Asia. Guam is a mini Hawaii. Guam is strategically invisible. Guam is published by the Guam Hotel and Restaurant Association and the Guam Visitors Bureau. Guam is a beach for sunburnt tourists in bikinis. Guam is an acronym for Give Us Asian Money. Guam is air-conditioned. Guam is updating its Facebook status. Guam is a punchline in Hollywood movie jokes. Guam is being used to film 3 Hollywood movies in the coming years. Guam is learning English as a colonial language, ECL. Guam is frequent flyer miles. Guam is endangered. Guam is one of our most curious possessions. Guam is no longer Guam.
Craig Santos Perez, reading the first poem of his poetry collection From Unincorporated Territory, Guma. What prompted you, Craig, to begin your book this way?
Well, many people, you know, in the U.S. and internationally don't know anything about Guam, don't know where it is, don't know anything about its culture. And so I often find myself, whenever I travel or talk to people, always explaining what and where a Guam is. And so I wanted to start the poem that way to, you know, both ground the readers in, you know, some of that information so that they can continue reading through the book with a base of knowledge, but then to also kind of introduce them to the complexities of what Guam is and all its different statuses and what that might mean.
Were you tempted to start this book with a map of Guam in the Pacific?
I was tempted, and I actually used maps in my first book as, again, a way to ground the readers in the kind of space of the Pacific, especially of the Western Pacific. And so that poem functions as a kind of, you know, linguistic map. And so you have to, you know, what I hope is that people will then go online and try to find where Guam is now that they know all this strange information about it.
There's a poignant story in this book about a girl who is asked to go to the front of her classroom and point on a map to where Guam is. So I guess she no longer lives in Guam. Can you encapsulate that story for us?
Sure. So, you know, what our indigenous people are called are Chamorro, and a lot of Chamorros have been migrating away from the island for the past 50 years or so. At this point, about half of our of our total demographic population now lives off island. And so there are many stories of Chamorros who, you know, are going to school in the States and are asked to point out Guam, but because Guam is so small, it's only a 212 square mile island, it's often not on world maps. You can't actually find it. And so this story is very common, and I've experienced this in my life as well, trying to point to Guam and not being able to find it on the map. That particular story is actually of my mom, Helen, whose father was in the military, so their family was stationed and lived in many different states around the military bases. And so when she was going to school, you know, she was actually born in the States, went to school in, you know, different parts of the South and the East Coast, and then eventually in California. And that was one of her most poignant memories of being the front of the class, hearing stories about Guam from her mom, but not being able to find it on the map. And so I felt that that story is very powerful because that was something my mom experienced and something that gets passed down generationally, this kind of displacement and feeling of being lost.
You and your family moved from Guam to California in 1995 when you were a sophomore in high school. What prompted the move?
Well, I would have to bring my parents into the radio station since it was their decision. you know, but like many other Chamorros, we migrate for economic opportunities, for better education. I think that's what their intentions were for myself as well as my siblings. And, you know, during that time, Guam was kind of going through a recession, so there weren't a lot of jobs at the time. And both my parents had lived in California before. My dad was in the military at one point in his life, and so they had connections in California, and they were kind of just searching for a better life.
Your grandfather was in the U.S. military. Your dad was in the U.S. military. What's going on here? Why the attraction to that particular occupation?
Well, there are several reasons. A lot of it is economic. It's one of the major employers on Guam besides the tourism industry. And so a lot of Chamorros see this as a way, you know, to kind of move up in the world, to have a steady income. Of course, it also creates opportunities for travel, to develop different skills. And so that's one of the major reasons, economic. It also, because Chamorros have been joining the military for several generations now, it becomes genealogical, where, you know, you see your grandfather do it, your father do it, there becomes this familial pressure to also enlist and to kind of carry on that legacy. A lot of scholars of Chamorro studies point as well to World War II, where Guam was occupied by the Japanese military for 3 years. And in 1944, the U.S. returned and so-called liberated the island from Japanese occupation. And so scholars argue that there's a sense of gratitude that that particular generation feels to the U.S. military because the Japanese occupation was quite brutal. And so we often view enlistment as payment towards this debt of liberation.
It's payment toward a debt. And yet, as you, in a sense, document in this book of poems, a lot of people from the island of Guam have died in combat as part of the U.S. military.
That's right. So we have some of the highest enlistment rates of any state or territory. We have some of the highest, you know, of course, killed in action rates as a result. We have some of the highest rates of, you know, portion of population that's actually a part of the military. So pretty much every family has someone who's in the military. And so what happens is, you know, there becomes a way that this becomes part of the culture, becomes part of our everyday landscape. It becomes normal and natural. Sadly, one of the effects, besides the loss of many sons and daughters who die in the various wars over the decades, is that our veterans, when they come back home, they don't really get the treatment they need. So besides being one of the highest enlistment rates, we also have the lowest rate per spending per veteran on island, and veteran healthcare back home is in desperate need of some funding because a lot of our veterans are just coming back, you know, with PTSD, with other health issues, and they're not being treated with the kind of respect that I think, you know, they deserve.
In high school, you were recruited. There was a recruiter on campus. You, I think, even went to a meeting, and I think someone even came to your house from the military. So what happened?
So during high school, they have the after graduation days where all the college recruiters come, military recruiters come, and you can actually get out of the class if you go to listen to their spiels. And so I signed up for everything just to get out a few classes. And, you know, the military, the Army recruiter specifically, he was a very cool guy. He was one of the few people of color that actually came and talked to us. And, you know, he kind of reminded me of my uncles, to be honest. And so I had good conversations with him, ended up visiting the Army recruitment office down in Fremont, which is south of here, about 30 minutes south of Berkeley. You know, and of course, you know, at that time, I didn't really have a critical consciousness of kind of the negative impact of U.S. militarism on our island or our people. So I just saw it as an opportunity, as a way that where I can get some skills as well as to pay for college, because, you know, my family had just moved to California a few years before that. And I had no idea how, you know, I was going to pay for college or my family was going to support that. So it looked really like silver lining. It just looked like a perfect opportunity to travel, gain some skills, you know, eventually pay for college as well. And then, you know, the recruiters, knowing I was interested, ended up coming to my house, I think, as the final push to get me to enlist. And at that point, my parents were actually very much against that, which was surprising to me.
Yeah, your father was against it, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, that very much surprised me. And actually, that led to us having a lot of conversations about, you know, what his experience in the military was like, which was very different because he was actually drafted to go fight in the war in Vietnam. And so his experience is very different and kind of a different generation as well.
But what were his reasons for him not wanting you to join the military?
Well, he saw a lot of violence and death and loss, I think, during Vietnam. He saw a lot of his, you know, his good friends that he grew up with basically leave and never come back. One of the first poems I actually ever published was based on a story he told me of him and a lot of other Chamorros who were fighting in Vietnam. They would go to this Vietnamese restaurant every weekend after their weekly, you know, assignments. And they would basically spend all their money buying all this food and just party it up on that one day because they didn't know if they would see each other the next weekend. And the thing that struck me about this story is that every week he said there would be more and more empty chairs around, you know, their banquet area that they used to hang out. And so that image of men disappearing and having these empty chairs in this restaurant really, really struck me, and ended up writing a poem about it.
Craig Santos Perez is his name. He's a poet and an associate professor of English at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. And we are talking about actually kind of his life and his investigations over time. His poetry collection is called From Unincorporated Territory, Guma. It's the third installment of a series of books, and a lot of it has to do with his family and with Guam and with what's been going on in Guam over many years, including the recent military buildup, U.S. military buildup on the island, and the impact that buildup has had and will have and might have on the people of Guam. So as I understand it, Craig, Guam was a Spanish colonial possession for centuries, and then the U.S. captured Guam in the Spanish-American War. There's a Treaty of Paris. Spain officially ceded the island to the U.S. in 1898. And then, except for these 3 years of Japanese occupation from something like 1941 to 1944, Guam has remained a U.S. territory. And before we talk about kind of the military buildup, its plans in the last, well, let's say in this century, what should we know about how the U.S. has used Guam in kind of a military and strategic sense since the beginning of the 20th century?
Well, Guam is the largest island in that part of the Western Pacific, has a deep protected harbor as well. So ever since the U.S. took over the island in 1898, it was a strategic, and that's one of their words, a location and site for the U.S. Navy. And it was seen as the tip of America's military spear in Asia. Guam is only a couple hours by flight from Japan and from the Philippines. And so it became a space for U.S. military hegemony in the Asia-Pacific region, at least in the Western Pacific. And so Guam has enough land for several airfields, and so it also has an important Air Force base, which became a crucial launch site during the Vietnam War. And Guam is also part of an archipelago called the Mariana Islands. And as a whole, those islands were also used as, you know, as other kind of military training grounds, weapons testings. There was a secret CIA training operations happening there during the Cold War. The atomic bombs that were dropped on Japan during World War II were also launched from the Mariana Archipelago. And so Guam, as being the largest island, bore, you know, a majority of the soldiers, the Air Force, as well as the Navy force in that region. Now, after the Japanese military bombed Guam pretty much at kind of the same time as Pearl Harbor, but they successfully occupied Guam. And so after World War II, the U.S. realized that, you know, this is an important site that we need to defend, and it can never be occupied by, you know, a foreign army ever again. And so in the decades post-World War II, they really refurbished the island to become what they call this unsinkable aircraft carrier. And so over the decades, they appropriated much more land, built up the military, brought in a ton of or thousands of foreign workers to build up this infrastructure. And, you know, ever since then, it's been one of the most important U.S. military bases in the world.
And in 2005, the U.S.-Japan roadmap for realignment implementation was announced. And you cover this. I mean, it's addressed in some detail in your book, From Unincorporated Territory, Guma. So what did this roadmap envision?
Mainly was a transfer of 8,000 Marines from Okinawa, many U.S. military bases in Okinawa, from Okinawa to Guam. As part of that transfer, there was going to be a buildup of facilities. A air and missile defense task force was going to be established. They were going to dredge the wharf so that they can berth nuclear aircraft carriers. And then they were also going to appropriate some land in an area called Pogget, which is one of our most sacred spaces, one of the most biodiverse spaces on island, and use it as a weapons, as a live fire training complex, what they call it. And so basically weapons testing. That was the plan. And it was when they released that roadmap, and, you know, so basically what they have to do is release a environmental impact statement. And so that came out a few years after the announcement. And when we saw the plan and how it was going to impact the island, both environmentally, culturally, socially, politically, you know, I refer to that impact statement as this kind of revelation of destruction. This was going to be how, this was their master plan for us and how it was going to devastate everything about the island and our culture.
Many of your poems consist of this draft environmental impact statement, public comments. So it was something like the plan was released in 2009, 11,000 pages in 9 volumes. The community had only 90 days to comment. What inspired you to, what motivated you not only to read these comments, but to essentially list some of them in your book?
Well, as part of the process of releasing these environmental impact statements is then the public has an opportunity to comment upon these impacts and to, you know, address possible mitigations. And because Guam is a territory, is a colony, we don't have much power or much say in these decisions. So these public hearings are spaces for us to testify and, of course, to protest. And each person gets about 3 minutes to say their piece. And there's a timekeeper, and often, you know, representatives from the military are there as well. And it was really powerful because, at least during my lifetime, this was the first time that I had witnessed such widespread activism against the military. Because so many Chamorros are in the military, and so much of our economy and our sense of identity relies on the military, to see people speak out against it was very profound. And, you know, because I wasn't home at the time as well, to me, these voices kind of carried and echoed not only across Guam and the Marianas, but across our entire diaspora. So it wasn't just a local issue. It became kind of a Chamorro diasporic issue as well. And so what happens is, you know, after they release the draft environmental impact statement, they listen to all the comments. You could also submit comments online or by mail. And then they publish all the comments in the final environmental impact statement after they make whatever changes they decide to make. And so that becomes like the last volume. And as a writer, it was such a profound moment and such a beautiful process for me after reading, you know, those 11,000 pages of, you know, a lot of technical language, a lot of, you know, just revelations of what they plan to do with our island, then to read all our voices speak out against it. And a majority of people are against that plan, particularly. Now, what I wanted to do, you know, again, as a writer and a poet and an activist, is to figure out ways to extend these voices. And so I started first putting my favorite ones on Facebook. And so that was great because people who, you know, were not at the actual hearings or who were not reading the documents, they could hear some of the objections to the military buildup. So I did that. I'm not sure. I forget how long. A couple months, I would do a few every day. So this was like a continual everyday kind of project. And then from there, I kind of culled it down to include this in the book as well. It's another way to extend and keep these voices alive. Because so much of the critique of this process is that they don't listen to our voices. You know, they have these public hearings. They give us opportunities to comment and testify, but they don't actually listen. And a lot of us were feeling like our voices were just buried and it was kind of a pointless exercise to keep going and keep testifying. And so I wanted to bring that into the poetry to extend the life of those voices, but to also show that, you know, this voice of protest is some of the most poetic moments that I think we can ever have in our lives when we stand up for the first time and speak out against, you know, devastation, against colonization. Like, that to me is the spirit of poetry.
I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Craig Santos Perez is my guest. He is a poet. He is a graduate of the UC Berkeley Ethnic Studies Department. He got his PhD there from there recently. He's a native Chamorro, born and raised on Guam. He migrated with his family to California in 1995. He now lives in Hawaii. And Craig, I'd love for you to read some of the comments, the public comments to this environmental impact statement. This was produced by the U.S. military in relation to a planned military buildup on the island of Guam. Can you read some of those comments?
Sure. I titled this series of poems Fatal Impact Statements. This is a huge document to digest. It doesn't matter what we gain from the buildup. It's what we lose. Buenas. First off, thank you for the false sense of participation created by the comment period. The opportunity to vent while completely meaningless is at very least cathartic. The destruction of the land is a sign of disrespect to our ancestors. How much sewage and solid waste can our island expect? Where are the comments to these issues sent? Who sees them? Will the public see any of these comments? My main reason for being against the military buildup is for what happened in Okinawa. A girl got raped. The lives of the native ocean inhabitants are more important than a parking lot for warships. They can't even pronounce the names of the villages right, for God's sake. I don't think I'm allowed to say that I'm against the military buildup because of my parents are for the buildup and my dad is in the Air Force. I cannot sit back any longer. We as a whole need to stop being shoved around and pushed back. What scares me is that I am a young female that is a target to those men who will be arriving. What if the people on Guam get outnumbered? I request an extension of the public commenting period. And if they do take the lands that they want, then what will the meaning of Guam be?
Craig Santos Perez reading from his book of poetry from unincorporated territory Guma. We have a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. It's published by Omnidon Publishing. One of the commenters referred to the population of the island and what might happen when the military buildup proceeds. Can you talk about the demographics of Guam and the proportion of people on Guam who are indigenous Chamorro and what's happened to that population?
There are about 175,000 people on Guam. About 35 to 40% are Chamorro, so between like 75, 80,000. Chamorros are still the single largest population group on island, although overall we are already outnumbered by other settler groups that have come to island. This has been a major shift in a very short amount of time. So before World War II, maybe about 90% of the island was Chamorro. The population was very small, about less than 23,000 or so. Since 1962, where there was a security clearance that was on the island, so you couldn't really leave or enter without Navy permission. So when that was lifted, there was an influx of people coming to Guam, but then that also initiated out-migration, mainly through the military as well. So, you know, military enlistment is actually the main vehicle of Chamorro migration over the last centuries, people joining the military and then being stationed elsewhere and bringing their families. And, you know, I talk about this a little bit in the book, but with every decade, we've seen more and more Chamorros leave island. So that at this point, at least from census records from 2010, there's about an equal number of Chamorros who live off island and on island. And, you know, likely in 2020, our off island numbers will actually outnumber our on island kin. And so that outmigration has been, you know, has caused a lot of different kinds of effects. You know, one, it's kind of, you know, a lot of culture has been lost, I think, because a lot of people leave. And so, you know, the Chamorro presence is not as everyday as it used to be. There's, of course, a loss of political power as well. There's a loss of connection to the land and the environment. And there's a lot of disconnection between families. So, you know, almost every family now, besides having, you know, members in the military, have members who are off island. And so even for myself, you know, I have my grandmother and a lot of aunties and uncles still live back in Guam, but then, you know, some live in Hawaii, some live in California. On both my parents' families, you know, they have brothers and sisters who live all over the states. And so, you know, at this point, the Chamorro population, at least according to the 2000 census, is described as the most dispersed of all the Pacific populations, because you could find Chamorros, you know, in Guam and in every single state, even in Puerto Rico. And so from, you know, just in the last 50 years, where almost all Chamorros lived in our archipelago, now we've seen just a vast migration outward.
And what impact has that had on you personally, emotionally, in terms of your understanding of home and perhaps how your idea of home has changed?
It's been something I've struggling with my whole life. I think, you know, a lot of Chamorros migrate when they're adults, either because they join the military or they go off to college or they go accept jobs elsewhere. Or a lot of Chamorros migrate when they're very young because their parents want to take them young, they can adjust more. And so it was hard for me to migrate when I was 15 years old in high school. And going to a new high school, trying to figure out how to drive on California freeways, that was maybe one of the most scariest experiences, to get my license here, learning on the 880 when I'd never been on a freeway like that before. And so there are kind of everyday things like that. Then there are deeper emotions where, you know, leaving all my friends back home, leaving the culture, being in a place where people look at me and they think, you know, I'm Mexican, or they think I'm, you know, something else that I'm not. And, you know, I felt like I lost a lot of my identity, lost a lot of the culture. And so writing became a way for me to stay connected or to hold on to memories that I had left, but then to also to kind of reconnect in ways that, you know, because I'm not able to be back home, then this is kind of my symbolic connection And that's one of the reasons why I use the word from a lot. And I work a lot in excerpts in the poem, because I often feel like I'm living this excerpted life where, you know, part of me exists one place and then part of me exists in another place. And I never feel quite whole because I've kind of had that uprootedness, I guess.
Craig Santos Perez joins me in studio. He is a poet, a native Chamorro, and he teaches English at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. We'll take a short break and speak more with Craig. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Craig Santos Perez joins us. He is a poet. He's co-founder of Ala Press. He is co-editor of the volume Chamorro Childhood and the editor of several special issues focusing on Chamorro and Pacific literature. Again, born and raised on Guam and migrated with his family to California when he was 15 years old, a sophomore in high school, and now lives in Hawaii. You've already referred to the issue of land and how that planned military buildup announced in 2009 that would take land, ancestral land, sacred land, and put it to military use. How much of the island does the U.S. military currently occupy, and how much has this land grabbing affected indigenous rights and indigenous land possession?
Well, the military bases occupy about a third of the island at this point, and it displaced a lot of people from their ancestral homelands. And once you remove people from the land, that creates a spiraling intergenerational effect. And so, of course, you remove them from, you know, their food sources, often if they were growing fruit trees or raising animals. You remove them from their subsistence living, and so they're often pushed into the wage economy. And in order to survive in that wage economy, you know, of course, you have to learn English. And oftentimes that meant that you had to join the military if that was the only job available, or to enter the tourism industry. And so, you know, not only removes people from a spiritual connection to the land, from a sense of caring for the land, from that ethics of sustainability, that, you know, if you're going to feed yourself and your family, you have to care for the land, you have to love it, you have to, you know, respect it as an ancestor, as kin, as home and shelter and sustenance. But when you're removed from that, you're also removed from those ethics. And, you know, that has a generational effect as well. And I think part of that, I would argue, is linked to our migration statistics as well, where, you know, before, many members of a family can live on one plot of family land that was taken care of. But once that land is taken away, then all those family members have to find other ways to support themselves. So then they often become separated. You know, there's one scholar who describes land as kind of the soul of Chamorro culture. And, you know, the military has kind of taken that soul away from us. And so much of Chamorro decolonial activism, demilitarization, and sovereignty is based on land struggles. And there's been a long history of trying to reclaim the land, and there have been, you know, small victories, but still that, you know, one third of the island is taken, and the island is small enough where there's, you know, causes real estate prices to be really high, causes other kinds of urban problems as well.
What do we need to know about what military landfills and the disposal of military wastes onshore and offshore, has done to people, to wildlife, to ecology.
Devastation. Yeah, the U.S. military has devastated the ecology of Guam in several different ways. One of the most well-known is that brown tree snakes were introduced to the island aboard these military ships sometime after World War II. There were not any of these kinds of snakes on island before. And so the snakes colonized the island in a very short matter of time. They basically wiped out our entire bird population so that you don't find any of the native birds in the wild anymore. And our birds that survived are all kept in captivity. There are these species survival plans. So if you want to see native birds, you have to go to the zoo or to certain Department of Agriculture compounds where they do these really strict breeding programs. And then they become these kind of tourist attractions at these different U.S. zoos, from the National Zoo to the Chicago Zoo to San Diego. And so that's one thing. We lost a lot of these birds, and the loss of the birds has created the spiraling effect in the ecology, where now we have higher rate of spiders on island than other islands as well, because the birds used to eat the spiders. Of course, birds spread seeds, and so now we're losing our native tree population as a result. So that's one of the kind of spiraling effects. In terms of just military waste, Guam has a large number of what they call Superfund sites. These are some of the most toxic military sites. There was the storage of Agent Orange and Agent Purple during the Vietnam War. So a lot of those contaminants went into the water and into the soil. What's scary is that we're still learning about all the contaminants that have been in the ground, in the water, in the air for the past 100 years. Guam has really high rates of cancer, other kind of neurodegenerative diseases. The military has also affected our body ecologies, our health. And so, they introduced a lot of U.S. foods, a lot of canned goods that were part of, these kind of militarized foods, these disaster foods that were brought in post-World War II when the U.S. bombed a lot of the island in the battle with the Japanese military.
So spam is no laughing matter here?
That's right. Spam is not a laughing matter. And our peoples became hooked to these imported foods. Also that relates to land displacement, because if you can't grow your food anymore, you still got to eat. And if that's the only options you have, it just becomes part of your body. And we have really high rates of diabetes, heart disease, obesity. And it's getting to kind of a crisis, precarious level, both on our physical bodies as well as our natural environments.
Craig Santos Perez, his latest poetry collection is called From Unincorporated Territory, Guma. Craig, can you read another poem from this volume?
Sure, I can read a short piece. It's from a series called Sounding Lines. And these are poems kind of explore different memories that I've had. This particular poem I'm going to read is related to time and time zones. Sounding Lines. Remember just the timetable Mom made and taped to the fridge. When it is 2 p.m. here, it is 8 a.m. the next day there. Mom always talking story on the phone, long distance counting minutes. When it is 11 a.m. there, it is 5 p.m. the day before here. Her voice, transoceanic cables, pool sounding lines between island and continent. When it is 6 p.m. here, it is 12 p.m. the next day there. She shows us how to dial 1-671, then the number. Rotary vocal cords pulse when it is 1 a.m. here, it is 7 p.m. the next day, passes into years. Fewer and fewer calls, lost connections, avian silence. I want to remember when we once belonged.
Lost connection. So the years go by and something changes, something is lost.
Yeah, so I wrote this poem, thinking about when we first moved. This was kind of before we had internet, and Guam lies across the international dateline, so the time difference was very confusing to us. And so my mom actually made this timetable so we could figure out when to call our friends and family back home. And at the time, Guam was considered international. And so it was very expensive. So we only had a certain amount of minutes each week that we could call our friends. That was like for the first year or so, you know, we spent a lot of money on phone calls. And it became unsustainable in some ways. And I think as a lot of people who migrate experience, you know, you start to lose those connections over time. And you know, I have one phrase where I talk about the avian silence. So I start thinking about the loss of our birds similarly as the loss of our people. You know, I mentioned the San Diego Zoo earlier. San Diego is also houses one of the largest chamorro populations. There's a large Navy base there. You know, so I'm just thinking about all these chamorros that leave island, you know, similar to how our birds have left as well. And it creates all this lost, you know, lost connections, as you put it. And, you know, just trying to think about how we can stay connected, you know, between this island and the continent.
Craig Santos Perez joins us in studio. He is a poet and he teaches English at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. We have links, by the way, to his faculty page, to his blog, and to his poetry collection from unincorporated territory Guma on our website, againstthegrain.org. This is Against the Grain. My name is C.S. Song. Well, you know, just to repeat the last line of the poem you just read, I want to remember where we once belonged. And you had a chance to do some remembering in 2010 when, after living in California for 15 years, after having lived in Guam for the first 15 years of your life, you returned to Guam. What stood out to you about that visit?
That I felt totally lost, you know, because I didn't learn to drive on Guam. I didn't remember like where to how to find stuff. And so it was very strange to look at maps, like to have to get out maps, online maps, as well as the printed ones, to try to find my way from the hotel I was staying at back to the house that my family grew up in. And so that was one thing that struck me, just how far away I still felt, even though I was actually there, and how much I didn't remember. I was also surprised about how much development there was. There were so many new buildings, new restaurants, new stores. You know, so there's this like loss of natural spaces, of green spaces that I wasn't quite prepared for. There's a lot more people. And maybe I just didn't notice it when I was a kid growing up. But, you know, going to the beaches, there were a lot more tourists than I remember. Going to, you know, restaurant or to stores, everywhere felt crowded. Traffic was crazy. And that was actually one of the major contentions about the military buildup, is that it's going to cause so much more traffic with all the new population of people. At the same time, I was very surprised about how welcoming people were to me. You know, a lot of family members and friends kind of embraced me as if I had never like left, as if I hadn't been gone for 15 years. And so that felt very nice, because I think one of my biggest fears was that no one would remember me.
Craig, I read that there are more Chamorros in California than in any other state. And yet, a lot of people have never heard the word Chamorro. So, you know, what's that like? What's it like to be part of an essentially invisible demographic? And what does that mean for what you would like to do in terms of perhaps changing the visibility of this population?
That's exactly how it's felt ever since I moved. You feel invisible. You feel unimportant. You feel like you don't matter. And you feel like you have no place in the larger story. And what I've tried to do in my work is to tell these stories, to make us visible, to make our history and our culture and our homelands visible. And, you know, I hope that through that awareness, we can feel comfortable telling our stories. We can think about why these things have happened to us. And we can understand our history better. We could understand ourselves better, and we could understand each other. You know, beyond that, I think it's important that Chamorros are visible because, you know, it's important to develop this kind of solidarity across the Asia Pacific region. And, you know, it's so important for, let's say, indigenous rights groups, you know, across the U.S., First Nations peoples in Canada, the Hawaiian struggle, the Chamorro struggle, other indigenous struggles in, you know, New Zealand and Australia. We're all fighting the same fight. And the more we can connect with each other, the stronger we can be to resist, you know, colonialism, imperialism, or, you know, what's at the forefront now, climate change. And if we don't come together and form, you know, a broad-based international movement, then we don't have much chance to survive. And this has really become as existential as that. And so that's part of my project as well, you know, being able, you know, to travel and to speak to different audiences and to make those connections. And to me, poetry is all about making connections.
Well, how would you assess, Craig, the degree to which connections have been made between and among indigenous rights struggles and the synergy that might or might not have already occurred and the solidarity that it could result in?
I've been seeing it a lot over the past decade or so. There are a lot of Pan-Pacific movements that are forming, getting to know each other, creating more solidarity. And part of that has to do with new technology. So social media, we can stay connected. We can hashtag, we can, you know, share on Facebook, we can update blogs. And through that, we can see how militarization, for example, affects us in different ways, but in very similar ways. There are also national organizations that are forming, you know, such as the Native American Indigenous Association that I've been a part of for several years, and has an annual conference. And at these conferences, you see indigenous peoples from all over the world get together. And we start to see similar histories of missionization, of boarding schools, of assimilation, of colonization. And, you know, we start to form those networks. We start to teach each other's texts in class. We start to learn about other struggles. It's inspiring. And I think that's what's really important, to know that, you know, we're not fighting this large imperial force alone. That there are people over, you know, in Canada or in Australia who are fighting the same fight. And we could learn from each other and we can strategize together and we could see what worked for them might work for us and what worked for us, you know, might work for them. And we could start to, you know, just really keep each other going, to give each other hope. And, you know, indigenous movements, the victories are sometimes so few and far between that when you see other people that are able to revitalize their language and create immersion schools, and we're like, we can do that too. Or you see other people, you know, stop a pipeline or stop a military base. And it's like, you know, it does happen and it is possible. And by forming these networks, we can continue to support each other and to give each other inspiration and hope that, you know, a different future is possible. And thinking about indigenous futures, having those two words together, I think, are, you know, just gives me enough energy to keep fighting and to keep writing the next poem and to do the next, you know, activist event or do the next protest.
Well, let's talk about the future. What do you think self-determination would look like, should look like for the people of Guam? What would it require?
Well, it would require first and foremost the deoccupation of our island, you know, which would essentially mean that the U.S. military would have to leave and return that land either into a trust or to the original landowners. You know, there's no reason why that land cannot be, you know, rehabilitated, because as we know, you know, ecologies are resilient. And, you know, right now we import about 90% of the food. There's no reason why we can't feed ourselves, why we can't grow our own food, because we did for thousands of years. And so those are, you know, two things are very important, is like land and then being able to subsist on our own. You know, from there, of course, there are other things in which we can determine how our resources are going to be used, to determine whether tourism is our best industry. You know, we could determine land use practices. We could determine you know, different kinds of immigration laws, you know, where tax dollars should be spent, other kinds of programs that will maybe bring our people back home. But, you know, ultimately self-determination, you know, begins with education as well. So I think kind of reforming the education system, thinking about indigenous-based education so that people understand that colonization is not, you know, the only or most natural or normal form of life, that there are other possibilities, and that what independence might mean is that, you know, we control our own destiny and that we control our future.
How big a transformation in education in Guam would be required? I mean, what are Chamorro people in Guam told about their histories and about their relationship to the U.S.?
Well, when I was growing up, we weren't told anything, and it wasn't part of the curriculum I grew up with. And so I learned more about U.S. history and culture in school than I did about Chamorro history or culture. Now, thankfully, that's changing. There's, you know, a lot of Chamorro educators and activists that are really changing both the Department of Education as well as the University of Guam has a new Chamorro studies program. There are a lot of Chamorro scholars who are publishing this amazing research and bringing that research into the community. There's a lot of initiatives to teach Chamorro history, Chamorro language, and Chamorro culture at all levels. And so I think it's exciting to see that, even though I wish I had grown up with that, it's nice to know that the next generation will have that. Even though it's still a very colonial system, there are these kind of this indigenous resurgence from within that's changing it.
The book of poetry by Craig Santos Perez, entitled From Unincorporated Territory, Guma, just won an American Book Award. Congratulations, Craig.
Thank you so much.
And he is also an associate professor of English at University of Hawaii at Manoa. He blogs. We have a link to that blog on our website, againstthegrain.org. And he is co-editor of the volume Chamorro Childhood. Thanks so much, Craig, for joining us.
Thank you, CS. I really appreciate talking with you.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.